Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. At some point in the past 30-odd years, you may have contemplated saying no to Amazon. Maybe you were worried about the brick-and-mortar stores you grew up with, or maybe you were upset about labor practices in the warehouses or tactics described as union busting. Or maybe it was just the spectacle of the second richest person in the entire world wearing a cowboy hat to space. Whatever the case, after having these thoughts, you probably went and clicked add to cart anyway. It's Amazon. It's convenient. The prices are low. The selection is wide. The shipping is so fast sometimes, it's uncanny. But what if that's wrong? What if Amazon only seems like the best and singular option because it's squeezed out all the other options?
The FTC's lawsuit alleges that Amazon is now a monopoly, and it's effectively functioning as a gatekeeper, as a key distribution channel that's connecting millions of consumers and thousands of merchants that are dependent on Amazon to reach them.
That's Lina Khan, the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, which has just filed a lawsuit against Amazon. Khan is 34, but before she'd even finished law school, she wrote an influential paper about how to use antitrust law against the company. But what does it mean for us, for consumers, if Amazon really is a monopoly? I talked with Lina Khan. You've been involved in investigating, thinking about Amazon and antitrust for a very long time. And I wonder if there's a historical analogy for Amazon's position in the market now, whether it's in the 19th century or the 20th century.
You're absolutely right that there have been moments over the last century where the United States has similarly confronted monopolies that have captured control over key distribution channels or key arteries of commerce. If you look at the various antitrust lawsuits that the FTC or the Department of Justice have brought over the last century, you can think about Standard Oil, you can think about AT&T. There are various companies that similarly have established a monopoly position that ultimately the United States determined was unlawful. And Amazon is now using this monopoly power in ways that hurt both sets of customers, both the consumers as well as the merchants. Amazon has steadily been hiking the fees that it charges merchants. That's effectively a 50% Amazon tax. And we also allege that Amazon has actually quietly been hiking prices for consumers in ways that is not always so clearly visible, but at the end of the day can result in consumers paying billions of dollars more than they would if there was actually competition in the market.
Give me an example of that, if you wouldn't mind.
So one of the practices that the FTC's lawsuit alleges are illegal are what we call its anti-discounting practices. For merchants, it's more expensive to sell on Amazon, but their price on Amazon has to be lower than it is anywhere else. And practically what that means is that merchants raise their prices everywhere other than Amazon. And so in effect, Amazon's practices have actually been inflating prices across the internet. We also note that Amazon has actually been degrading the quality of its service over the last few years in particular, and Amazon's search page is now polluted with all of these advertisements. And what our investigation revealed is that these ads are not always relevant to consumers, but Amazon has determined that it can make more money by showing these users ads, even when those ads are not useful to people, even though those ads are actually steering people to higher cost products. Amazon has now been able to exercise its monopoly power in unchecked ways and in a way that means the American public is losing out.
Well, let's go back a little bit. How did Amazon get to this position? And what prevents anyone from competing against Amazon? What's illegal about it?
So what our lawsuit lays out is that you know, in some ways you can see how there is a monopoly life cycle, right? And in earlier stages, the tactics that a company uses to become a monopoly may in the short term be good for consumers. But what we now see with Amazon is that it's become so powerful. It's now enjoys a monopoly and it's extracting and exploiting that monopoly in ways that is harming both sets of customers. And in a competitive market, it would be disciplined. Because it would be hiking prices for merchants and merchants would actually have options for selling elsewhere. But that's just not what we see in this market. And we allege that's because of Amazon's anti-competitive practices.
I'm curious, you're 34 and you have an incredibly influential position. I'd just love to know how at law school you became attached to this issue. Why this issue?
So it's an interesting question, and I actually became interested in this issue before law school when I was a business reporter and was doing economic research, and my beat was market consolidation. And I was assigned to do a deep dive in all sorts of sectors of the U.S. economy, including chicken farming. And this is a market that's basically shaped like an hourglass. So you have millions of consumers on one end, millions of farmers on the other end, and they're all connected by a handful of chicken processors. If you're a chicken farmer, you're oftentimes actually just dependent on a single company to get to market. And that asymmetry of bargaining power has led to all sorts of abusive practices. And that overall made me aware of the ways in which consolidated power, concentrated economic power, can threaten fundamental liberties and freedoms in the same ways that we've long recognized concentration of political power can undermine democracy. And that's really what got me interested in the antitrust laws, which go back a century and were similarly animated by a fear of concentrated economic power. Lawmakers believe that in the same ways that our constitutional system creates checks and balances in our government sphere, we needed antitrust and anti-monopoly laws to create checks and balances in our commercial and economic sphere to similarly safeguard against concentrations of power.
You faced a crossroads in your life between becoming a journalist, going to the Wall Street Journal, and going to law school and pursuing the path you did. Why did you choose honest work?
You know, it was a tough call, and the Wall Street Journal job would have been a commodities beat reporter. And at that point, I was really interested in commodities markets. But ultimately, I thought it would take me away from antitrust and anti-monopoly issues. And at that time, I thought, you know, the moment was ripe for reinvigorated antitrust. And so law school would be the way to go.
Do you use Amazon?
Occasionally, I'm not a prime user, but, you know, once in a while, if there's something I need.
What do you use it for?
I recently had a baby. And so, you know, once in a while, if I need something, you know, be it diapers or wipes or whatnot, I've used it.
When Amazon first came along, I'm a book reader and I live in New York City. There are plenty of bookstores, although they're diminishing. And I made the obvious discovery. I can get anything on Amazon, whereas I can't get anything, even if I try, in bookstores. And it had a certain allure. And I think this goes with other products as well. So how do you deal with that problem? In other words, it's enormously popular as well as a gigantic conglomerate.
What this lawsuit is ultimately about is wanting to make sure we have the open, competitive markets that allow the next set of Amazons to come along. And what our lawsuit finds is that because Amazon has insulated itself off from those competitive pressures, it's able to actually hurt its customers with impunity. It's not always going to be visible because Amazon's using these secret pricing algorithms that are raising prices without people often detecting it. But I think on the quality dimension, people can see how, you know, if you're searching for a product, the first dozen may be for irrelevant products. You may have to scroll down a whole bunch to even find what you're looking for. And then for the merchants as well. I mean, you know, we're consumers, but a lot of people are also entrepreneurs or also small businesses. And Amazon's own documents reveal that it recognizes that these merchants live in constant fear of Amazon's punishments and punitive tactics. And ultimately, our antitrust laws are about preserving open markets, but also making sure people have the economic liberty to not be susceptible to the dictates of a single company.
What's an example of a would-be competitor to Amazon getting crushed under the wheels of Amazon's tactics?
It can be difficult to fully capture the competition that's been lost, the innovation that's been lost, all of the benefits that have been foregone, because these are entire trajectories that have been lost to us because of Amazon's practices.
Now, what is Amazon arguing in the case? They say that Amazon is highly entrepreneurial. It's responsible for nearly 40% of e-commerce sales and allows 500,000 independent sellers to sell their products online, whereas they might have languished without the rise of Amazon. What do you say to that?
Ultimately, this is about wanting to make sure we have the market conditions for the next set of successful companies to be able to enter the market and compete on the merits. What you really want in an open competitive market is for companies to fail or succeed based on whether customers like their product, based on whether they have, you know, savvy business strategies. And unfortunately, we've seen in this market that even if a retailer was more efficient, even if a retailer had better prices, because of Amazon's anti-competitive restraints and the anti-competitive tactics, those firms would not be able to get a fair shake in the market.
What could Amazon do to be less anti-competitive, and how would consumers benefit?
So our lawsuit identifies two sets of practices. One is the set of anti-discounting practices that I described, all of these tactics that they use to basically elevate prices on Amazon, but also on other retail channels. We also note that Amazon basically prohibits and makes very difficult what's known as multi-homing, where they effectively require that if you're a merchant that wants to make a whole bunch of sales on Amazon, you have to also use what's known as fulfillment by Amazon. And what this effectively does is makes it much more difficult for sellers to also sell on other platforms. There was a moment in time when Amazon actually relaxed this coercive tie, and this program was enormously popular, but Amazon quickly recognized that allowing merchants to use other fulfillment providers could actually also empower other retailers and other platforms, because you would basically have a platform agnostic fulfillment provider that sellers could use to build up business elsewhere. And ultimately, Amazon recognized that that was a competitive threat, and so it shut it down. And so if you're Amazon, the biggest threat to you competitively would be if a different platform also built up a critical mass of customers, a critical mass of merchants, and started benefiting from the accelerated growth that digital markets can provide. And so once Amazon itself developed and established that enormous scale, it's undertaken a whole set of tactics to make sure nobody else can become even remotely as big.
In the history of antitrust law, you've had instances where dominant and domineering companies have been broken up, whether it's in the oil industry, the railroads, and so on. Do you want to see Amazon broken up?
And when you think about effective remedies, you want to make sure that the competition that's been lost is fully restored. And when you have digital markets, you know, the relationship between the anti-competitive practice and the harm is not one-to-one. It's exponential. The harms in these markets accumulate, they aggregate in exponential ways. And at the end of the day, that means you may need a more significant remedy. We want everything to be on the table, including breakups.
I think you're telling me the answer to my question is yes, you want to see it broken up.
Well, look, again, I don't want to get ahead of the lawsuit, but historically there have been all sorts of remedies, including breakup, but including, you know, other types of commitments that the firms have to make. In this instance, we're really focused on whatever addresses the problem. The important thing here is we need to be sensitive to the particularities of digital markets. And so we're going to want to make sure that we're fully explaining to the judge how these markets work and help the judge reach a determination about what an effective remedy would look like.
Do you think the tech companies benefited by the fact that unlike you know, the robber barons in their top hats and their big bellies and, you know, the kind of cartoonish, rapacious imagery that surrounded them, that, you know, these guys in, you know, khaki pants and polo shirts and a very different set of imagery. And also people were very taken with the tech revolution. Do you think that made the government slow to look hard at these companies and monopolistic practices?
I think it's certainly true that when we saw the advent of digital markets, there was a sense that these markets are so new, they're so fast moving, they're so dynamic, that the best thing for the government to do is to step back and get out of the way. And I think, unfortunately, we've come to regret that. We've seen all sorts of instances in which there were missed opportunities to stop illegal acquisitions or to stop illegal or predatory business models from getting a hold. I think, as we see from Congress, there's a lot of concern about people's privacy and the way about how some of these business models incentivize the endless hoovering up of people's sensitive data, be it their geolocation data, be it their health data. It's undermining people's privacy. It's hurting kids. So I think we're now, you know, reeling from that. I think the government's attention on AI is also now informed by some of those missed opportunities. And there's a great sense that we don't want to repeat the mistakes of, you know, Web 2.0 and the social media companies.
What's the biggest mistake we could be making where AI is concerned?
Well, I think we need to be very vigilant about whether we are again going to have a system in a market where a handful of companies control all of the relevant inputs, all of the relevant tools and technologies, be it cloud computing, be it the relevant base models and all of the data, especially if AI becomes essential to a whole set of markets. What we don't want is for the rest of the economy to be dependent on the decisions of a handful of gatekeepers.
Now, we're talking a lot about Amazon here, but other tech companies like Google and Meta have been in the crosshairs of federal agencies too. The FTC dropped an antitrust case against Meta, but this month, 41 states sued Meta for a different reason, that their social media platforms are addictive and harm kids in some ways. It's rare that we see this kind of bipartisanship in federal regulation. What do you make of that?
I think you're absolutely right that there is just a deep sense in a bipartisan way that some of these companies are now exercising unaccountable power in ways that's really hurting us. It's hurting our pocketbooks, but it's also hurting our privacy. The state lawsuit that you mentioned really takes after some practices that the states allege are hurting kids, including hurting their mental health. And so I think we are really at a crossroads where there's a bipartisan recognition that unchecked monopoly power is bad for Americans. There's a long and rich American history of us taking on unchecked monopoly power and making sure our markets are open and fair and competitive.
Do you have similar bipartisan support around the Amazon case that we've seen in the Meta case? Where do you think the politics come down?
So our lawsuit we were joined by a whole set of state attorneys general, including a few Republican states. So we've been pleased with that Republican support for the lawsuit. I'll also note that in Congress, you know, there are various efforts to be legislating in ways that would address Amazon and all sorts of other companies, and those efforts are bipartisan as well.
Do you find that there's a sophistication about the tech companies in Congress? I say that in a leading sort of way because when I watch sometimes public hearings, committee hearings about tech, the level of cluelessness among members of Congress can sometimes be stunning.
Look, I had the great honor of working for a congressional antitrust subcommittee that undertook an investigation into Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. And, you know, the members on our subcommittee were enormously sharp. They enormously understood the very real risks. And we're very proud of the work that came out of those efforts. I think more generally, you know, members of Congress are now hearing directly from their constituents, you know, concerns about kids' privacy, concerns from merchants, concerns from startups and entrepreneurs that have been locked out of markets. And so I think in a very real sense, they're seeing and learning and hearing directly about the power of these companies. And so I think, you know, that's driving a lot of the forward movement.
Finally, in the history of trust busting, you saw real breakthroughs during the Progressive Era and then again during the New Deal era. Do you think we're on the cusp of that kind of situation?
I think this is certainly a historic moment in antitrust. And President Biden has identified reinvigorated antitrust and anti-monopoly as a key objective of this administration. We at the FTC are really proud to be on the front lines of that effort. But it's really a whole of government effort right now to be reinjecting fair competition. And, you know, I think all too often people feel like they don't get a fair shake in our economy. And reinvigorated antitrust is a key part of fixing that.
Lina Khan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Lina Khan, chair of the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC has filed a landmark antitrust case against Amazon in September, along with 17 states. You can read more about it from our business reporter, Sheila Kolhatkar, at NewYorker.com. Amazon is fighting that suit, saying the FTC is, quote, wrong on the facts and the law. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The rift inside the Democratic Party now over Israel and its campaign in Gaza is profound. And this week on our podcast, The Political Scene, Andrew Marantz talks about Israel and the left and how the divide may be impacting the presidential race. Andrew Marantz joins host Tyler Foggett on The Political Scene, a podcast from The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Emerald Fennell was an accomplished actor before making her debut as a writer and director with Promising Young Woman. Fennell's second movie comes out this month, and she sat down to talk about it with Michael Shulman, who covers culture and entertainment for The New Yorker. Here's Michael.
You might know Emerald Fennell for her acting work. She played Camilla Parker Bowles on the middle seasons of The Crown. I actually couldn't talk to her about any of her acting because of the SAG strike. But she has emerged in recent years as a really provocative, hot-button-pushing filmmaker. Her first movie, Promising Young Woman, came out in 2020, and it was just a movie that people loved to argue over. It was a feminist revenge thriller, and chances are, if you saw it, you either loved it or hated it. But she won the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. So now she's back with her second film, Saltburn. It draws on the Evelyn Waugh novel, Brideshead Revisited, and it follows a middle-class Oxford student, played by Barry Keoghan, who falls in with a handsome aristocratic classmate, played by Jacob Elordi. And so the Barry Keoghan character goes to spend the summer with this guy's family at their luxurious country estate, also called Saltburn, and more or less infiltrates their lives. Emerald Fennell does not do things halfway. She really goes dark. She's not a crowd pleaser. And I have a feeling that Saltburn is going to get people talking just as Promising a Woman did. I imagine that it was really important not only just to cast the actors, but to cast the house of Saltburn. You found this place that dates back to the 14th century. Can you tell me how you found it, how you chose it?
It was really important to me. And it's funny that you say casting, because it absolutely did feel exactly as important. It is a character. And me and Linus, the wonderful cinematographer, talked a lot about shooting the house as a sex object, as a kind of fetish. You know, we're always sliding up and down staircases, and it's, you know, it's sort of part of the like erotic texture of the film, really, the house. And so many of these houses have been in, you know, because we're so successful at exporting the aristocracy abroad. So we've seen them all, at, you know, we've seen Gosford Park, and we've seen The Remains of the Day, and we've seen Downton Abbey.
Right.
And all of those are within a certain, usually within a certain kind of area of shooting near London. So we knew we'd have to go much further out to find it. And then, you know, part of it we shot because of all of the oneers and the way I like to work it. It had to be one place, but it also meant we all became immune to the beauty immediately. And you need that feeling, right? Of like, oh, you're just walking through it. And after a couple of weeks, you're like, oh, it's so big. How am I getting from A to B? You know, it's no longer the most beautiful, overwhelming thing you've ever seen. It's suddenly just another thing.
Well, but that's the point, is that the people who live there could care less. They're so used to their lives of luxury. This movie is such a vicious satire of the kind of idle rich. Is that how you see it? And what interested you in sort of observing this sliver of aristocracy?
Yes, it's absolutely a satire. But it's also a satire of those of us who want in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually, it's not just, of course, you know, the absurdities of the class system and, you know, which I'm, you know, very much like a part of, as every single person in England is. But really, it's about our willingness to prostrate ourselves at the altar of beauty and wealth, always, and our longing for it. And even when we know better, even when we know that it's not good for us, even though we know that it's never going to love us back, that these systems are just like in place to make us feel ugly and stupid and boring and, you know, whatever, we're still on our knees. We, all of us are. And so, yes, absolutely, it's a class satire. But the thing for me that I wanted it to feel more like is about what is our relationship with the things we want? Why do we hate them so much? Why do we hate them as much as we love them? Mm. Why do men look at beautiful women on the internet and because they're so aroused by them, they want to strangle them? Where is that impulse from? You know, what is this constant sort of voyeurism and need and want and endless wanting and looking? What does it do?
Mm.
And so, yes, I hope absolutely it's like a comedy of manners and a social satire, but I'm interested in like being a human inside of all of this and what motivates us and the British class system and the house. And it's all really, you know, it could be any number of things that we are pressing our faces against, I guess.
Well, I'm curious how you drew on your own life and background in satirizing or anatomizing the British class system. In this movie, you're not someone who's coming from the wrong side of the tracks and, you know, peering through the windows like Oliver is. You seem to grow up in a very rarefied setting. Your father, Theo Fennell, is known as the jeweler to the stars, the king of bling. And, you know, you went to the same boarding schools, Kate Middleton, and then to Oxford. I'm kind of just curious, like, with your father, you know, the people he supplies jewelry for have included Madonna, Elton John, who's a family friend. Growing up, how did you sort of process this rarefied world you were living in?
But this is so interesting because this is all about the intricacies of the class system. Because I would say, what I would say is, oh, that's very much pressing your nose against the window. Because actually, the psychotic detail of the class system means that actually, I mean, do you think you're thought of as being very, very, very posh if your father is known as the king of bling? You know, do you know what I mean? Right. So suddenly, yes, of course. But this is what's fascinating is that, yes, by any standards, my life has been absurd parade of mad privilege, of course. I mean, and I'm very aware of that. But also on the other side of things, my parents both, you know, my father's was, his family were in the army. My mother's family, you know, ran a farm, were farmers in rural Wales. And they both, you know, they both went to London to make themselves and they both worked and worked and worked. You know, I suppose everyone in my family would just, we're pretty, you know, a bit flashy, some would say, and certainly in Britain, that would be a real slam. You know, there's a kind of...
I see what you mean. This is very different from America where, you know, wealth is flash.
Well, I think, but everywhere, again, it's just about where this, again, it's like, it's all about learning the rules. And so, you know, for me too, I had to learn those rules. But if you are a writer, or if you are a maker of things, I guess, you're a voyeur and you're a watcher and you're interested in detail and you're interested in how people communicate with each other. You're interested in how you transform yourself to make yourself more palatable to other people. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things are true. Yes, I'm, you know, from a very kind of, you know, grew up in very rarefied circumstances, but also there are places where that wouldn't be the case at all. You know, there are, you know, I went to Oxford, and there are lots of different subdivisions there too. There are, you're divided up constantly until you're a tiny little slither.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Oxford. You know, Saltburn begins at Oxford, where these two students befriend each other from across this class divide. And I'm curious if there were things from your own experience there that you directly drew for the movie, or maybe more thematic things that found their way in.
Well, I think I did probably what 1,000 people who go to Oxford did, which was I wanted to be a kind of louche, chain-smoking, sexy genius having affairs with my tutors, and of course it was just not I've always felt like a profoundly unserious person, and so it was very important to me to go to a place that I could at least point to so that people might one day take me seriously even if they didn't. But I don't know what I was looking for quite, but it's also just a time of your life where you can be anything. And I don't think that lying is... I don't think of myself as a liar at all. I hope I'm very honest. But that's what a liar would say.
Well, and I imagine you didn't lead with people saying, hey, my father's the king of bling.
I mean... Maybe I did, though.
Maybe you did.
Maybe to be with certain people, that's right. Probably what I did do.
And you were acting during this time, right?
Did
you think of yourself as someone who wanted to be a director someday, or were you primarily focused on being an actress?
No, I think I was writing a lot. I did an English degree. And I think, actually, it was really interesting. I met Marielle Heller for the first time yesterday, the amazing director. And she said something that really struck me, which was that the only visible job for a woman on a film or a TV set was an actor. And I felt that very strongly because I think that is probably the truth for me too, is that now I know that this is the only thing I ever wanted to do. But I didn't know that it existed. I suppose that acting was the thing that I, because we don't really have film schools in the same way in England as you do here. And I didn't really, and there weren't any female directors at the time. I mean, of course, there are lots at the time, but I mean, just in terms of just sheer volume, there wasn't anyone that I could, I looked up to all of the like female comedians who wrote their own things. I looked up to kind of Jennifer Saunders and Dawn French and people like that. But I suppose that acting, I love acting. Whether or not I'm particularly good at it, I don't really know. But I think that I wanted to write and I wanted to make things. I wanted to make the stuff that I thought about.
Well, you know, both of your films, Promising a Woman and Saltburn, I would describe as darkly perverse, which is a compliment. They start dark and they get even darker. Were you always like that?
Yeah, I think so. There were a lot of calls to my parents to, you know, to come and have a talk about a piece of creative writing I'd done when I was in, you know, primary school. I don't know what it is. I don't know where it comes from. But I think that I want to push something. I want to press something. And I want to talk to people. I want to talk about things, and I don't know how else to talk about them. And it's interesting when you make a film, particularly a film like Promising a Woman, people expect you to have an answer always. Mm-hmm. And I don't have one. And it's the same with, you know, it's the same with Saltburn. But it's interesting. I think it is also interesting that actually a lot of it is sort of just the work of imagination, which is something that, you know, maybe we talk less about like in interviews maybe than the like real life things that inspire it. But I just, yeah, I don't know. I suppose I'm interested in like why we all love popping zits and why people watch it on the internet and what that squeamish pleasure is.
Emerald Fennell talking with Michael Shulman about her new film, Saltburn. The conversation continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Michael Shulman is a staff writer covering arts and entertainment for the New Yorker, and he's speaking today with the writer, director, and actor, Emerald Fennell. Fennell made the 2020 film Promising Young Woman. It starred Carey Mulligan, and it was one of those movies. It seemed like everybody was talking about it, and not without some controversy. We'll continue that conversation now.
Well, this would be a good time. So I don't want to spoil anything about Saltburn. Obviously, people haven't, in general, seen it yet. But maybe this would be a good time to talk about the ending of Promising Young Woman. If people, you know, people have had 3 years.
Yeah,
but
get on with it, guys.
Spoiler alert, in 3, 2, 1, your heroine, Cassie, played by Carey Mulligan, is on a quest to sort of avenge her best friend's rape. And instead of carrying out this revenge in the way that the audience might be rooting for, she finally gets the rapist cornered and he frees himself and smothers her with a pillow. And she has a kind of final victory from beyond the grave. This was a really divisive, polarizing argument starting ending. And I'm curious, what effect did you want it to have on the audience? Did you think about that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course. I think for me, it was the purpose of the film was not just to kind of examine the very recent past where all of the nice people that I knew did all of the things in this film. And so in many ways, that scene where Cassie dies, which was in real time, you know, so I found out how long it would take for somebody to be suffocated to death. And the answer was about 2.5 minutes. So it's a 2.5 minute shot pushing in.
Excruciating.
It's excruciating. And it ends on him. You know, he then becomes our protagonist, her murderer.
Hmm.
And it's not just that scene that's very important in the film, but it's the scene after where his best man comes in. And it's the most broadly comic. It's the most broadly comic scene of the whole film.
She's dead, Joe. Come on. I'm not kidding.
All right, you're being ironic.
What?
You killed the stripper at your bachelor party? What is this, the 90s? Ow. Classic.
And we're all laughing because we've seen it. We're all laughing because we've seen it and we know it. And that was always part of it for me is to really talk about how we get catharsis and how we and to try and explain to people that it's no use saying why didn't you
mm-hmm.
because this is the answer. The winning is relentless and excruciating and often feels very futile.
Well, it really complicates the relationship, the audience's relationship with our protagonist in a way that I think Saltburn does in a different but related way, which is that, you know, our instinct is to root for this person whose story we're seeing, who it seems like somewhat of an underdog. I think that the people who recoiled at that end of Promising Young Woman felt like, wait a second, is this supposed to be a victory for her? Because I don't feel like it is. I felt personally like it's okay. I understand that I'm supposed to feel queasy and maybe even question her self-destructive instinct, which may be something like a death wish, or there's something kind of psychopathic about her.
Do we question that when it's John Wick getting revenge on his puppy? Do we say, why is he putting himself in these dangerous positions? Do we do it when men go on revenge quests and die heroically at the end? We don't, because it looks different. And, you know, there were a lot of conversations at the time about the kind of, you know, the relationship of the cops to her and the fact that they kind of arrest him at the end. And it's sort of fascinating because the cop, the male and female, but mostly the male policeman in this is the most useless, misogynistic person. He goes and interviews Beau's character, who's a kind of children's doctor, and is completely overwhelmed by him. And I mean, you know, Beau was directed to give the most.
This is Beau Burnham.
Sorry, Beau Burnham, who plays Dr. Ryan, who's Cassie's love interest.
The ultimate nice seeming, decent guy who turns out to be yet another.
Yeah.
Schmuck.
Disappointing schmuck. Yeah. So, but he was directed in that scene to be as shifty and guilty seeming as possible.
Yeah.
And the policeman is like, just keep feeding him all the information to free himself.
Between you and me, it sounded like she wasn't feeling so good. Mentally, I mean. Her father seemed to think she was a little unstable.
Yeah, she was not in a good place.
Do you think she might have wanted to hurt herself?
Yeah. She could have. She could have, yeah.
I thought that might be the case. Thank you for your honesty.
Also, we don't see the court case. Probably gets off, you know, scot-free.
Well, that's what some people argued. Yeah, well, it's a criticism. How is this a victory if he's just going to get off on self-defense?
Well, but it's not a victory. There is no victory. That's the point of the film. There is no victory to be had. But also, when you're making a film like this, you also have to, you kind of have to acknowledge that for it to hit widely, you can't be so nihilistic that you know, because the original ending did end with not just the best man and the kind of perpetrator burning her body, but everyone from the bachelor party standing around the mountains, and that was the end. And you know, the initial argument was that was just too bleak, that actually it would be impossible for people to engage with it. They'd be too annoyed. And of course,
who was making this argument?
You know, the usual people, lovely, well-meaning, honest people who I work
like
with.
Producers, studio
heads.
Yeah,
like all of those people. And I, of course, initially my first thing, like any person, was you're fucking idiots and you hate art and you hate women and I hope you all die slowly and tonight.
well, and, I'm sure there were people who felt that even your final ending was unbearably bleak and why can't we just end with a bang?
But that was the thing, is that actually
with her glorious
with her winning.
Victory. Yeah.
But this is the thing, you know, is that actually they were right. They were right.
It reminds me of Fatal Attraction, which famously had a reshot ending. You know, it originally ended with the Glenn Close character slitting her throat in the bathroom alone. And this was so horrifying to the studios, basically, that they came and reshot it with, you know, the wife character, like, shooting her in the head and sort of protecting the family and the, you know, the sort of stalker, evil, chaos-causing woman is sort of cast out like a monster. But that's, like, those are the Hollywood rules, which you sort of undermined with your ending.
Thank you. But I think also that's it. You have to also operate within those rules because you also want the most people to watch something and engage with it. I think the thing that I'm coming to terms with is that I think perhaps as a female filmmaker more than any other kind, you are sort of still expected to be maybe a memoirist. People are more comfortable with that still. And so I found the personal, the fact that I was always such an intrinsic part of the work difficult, because actually, even though, you know, because of the actor's strike and all these sorts of things, I'm sort of here talking about these things, I would really rather it existed without me, that people were able to look at it without me. And so I found that difficult because I think you hope the thing speaks for itself, but you also don't. You know, me and Carrie were at a point with Promising Young Woman where we were constantly being asked about our personal relationship to the material, and really quite kind of openly, frankly, being asked in what manner we'd been sexually assaulted, and could we please detail it in lovely graphic detail to the man who just introduced himself to us via Zoom. You know, it was kind of bleak. And I think that stuff is the stuff that I always will find difficult because it's necessary. But I also feel like you sort of want to step away from it a little bit yourself.
For sure. I mean, so much of the press around Promising Woman had to do with you as a specifically female storyteller showing a female point of view and how women experience issues like consent and sex and harassment so much differently than men, just like a different universe. Saltburn really is about men primarily. You know, the central relationship is between these two men. Did that interest you, like exploring male friendship?
Male friendship is a really excellent way of describing the things that happen here.
Yeah, it's insufficient to this relationship
friendship
in the movie.
With a big wink.
male ways of relating to each other.
I guess. Well, again, you know, perhaps in 2006 as well, even more than now, there feel like more barriers between male friendship physically, so less now than, but you know, with all my female friendships were very tactile. You're often entwined together, for example, certainly growing up at that age. You know, when you're a young woman, you often change in front of your friends. You're often in the bath in front of your friends. You're often talking about masturbating. You're often, you have intimate relationships that are kind of maybe a bit different, certainly again, during the period that this was in. And so, you know, I suppose that this film about a kind of bottomless well of desire that can't ever be sated kind of felt uniquely male. But again, you know, that's just me honestly pulling something out of my ass because you asked me. I think truthfully, it just was.
Right.
And I'm interested in men and boys as much as I am in women and girls. You know, we're all in it.
A couple of years ago, it was announced that you were making a film about the character Zatanna for DC Comics. And you've also been attached to a Nemesis movie at Marvel. First of all, I'm curious, are those still happening? Are they still in the works?
No, those aren't in the works. So Nemesis was, I think, that was a few years ago, and that was that wasn't anything I was ever like formally attached to, but did some work on early on. And it was one of those things that it interested me because I like genre. I wasn't at the time hugely familiar with the superhero genre actually. And I thought, well, this would be interesting if I could make a film that would appeal to me, maybe, and people like me, which is, you know, maybe people who wouldn't traditionally go and see those films, then that felt like a really fun exercise. But I think that the truth of it is I am much, much, much better on my own. The development process, the traditional development process, is one that I've done in the past for lots of reasons, and I do love collaborating with people, but it doesn't work for me. I can't do outlines, can't have endless conversations about ideas before writing. For me, I can't write anything down until it's finished, because once it's down, it's sort of, it feels complete. Not entirely, you always have to change things a little bit, but it's sort of a secret. It has to be a secret. And if you're going to be really honest with yourself and you're going to write the things that you find really troubling and interesting and sexy and difficult, you kind of can't, you need to sort of work it out in your head alone.
So are you at all interested in doing like a superhero or franchise movie, or is the sort of corporate mechanism around it where you have to outline things just the barrier of entry at this point?
Yeah, I think so. And I honestly don't know is the answer. Like, certainly for the next few films, if I'm allowed to make them, I already know what they're going to be of my own. And that's, you know, I've got two small kids, like, I can only ever do one thing at a time. So I do one thing at a time. And so at least for a few years, again, if I'm not, you know, if I'm allowed to, I'll just make my own things. But, you know, you never know. Doing something that's difficult or that seems counterintuitive is always something that appeals, but certainly not for a while.
Well, Emeril, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
The New Yorker's Michael Shulman spoke with writer, director, and actor Emeril Fennell. Her film Saltburn comes out on the 17th. You can find much more from Michael Shulman at newyorker.com. He just profiled director Ridley Scott, looking at his new historical epic, Napoleon. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the show this week. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.